It wasn't so long ago that just about everybody in this country would have called themselves a Christian. It's true other religions did exist, but they were so ethically and culturally remote from our culture and location that they could be contemptuously disdained as mere pagan superstitions. True, there were skeptical philosophers, some of whom even dared openly to confess themselves as atheists in this country. But such opinions were generally regarded as bizarre and even scandalous. Toleration in the 18th and 19th centuries in Britain referred only to different branches of the church. No one seriously suggested that those of other faiths, or even of no faith at all, should be treated with the same respect as a Christian gentleman. The very idea was unthinkable. Christendom was synonymous in the Western mind with civilization. If you didn't subscribe to the former, you had very dubious title to the latter. But that, I stress again, is how things used to be. You don't have to be a particularly acute social observer to realize that the 20th century has witnessed an extraordinary reversal of that Christian privilege in our country. Under the pressure of international trade and technological advances in transport and communication, and I suppose most serious of all, the fear of war, we can no longer treat other religions with indifference, for the world has become a global village. Other religions are now on our doorstep. Indeed, in post-colonial immigration into Britain has brought mosques and Hindu temples over the threshold into our high streets. Nor can irreligion any longer be dismissed as an eccentricity espoused only by a lunatic fringe. If you ask any RE teacher, they will confirm that in an average class of schoolchildren today, you won't find more than one or two on average, known as Christians by their peers. The Christian consensus, then, which for over a millennium has been the ideological foundation of European civilization generally, and particularly culture in this country, is crumbling away. And in its place, a new kind of society is emerging. A society in which Christianity is no longer privileged as it once was. True, there are still plenty of church spires breaking up the city skyline, but these days they are dwarfed by the skyscrapers of contemporary commerce. True, bishops still sit in the Houses of Parliament, but their influence in the political direction of this country is today almost nil. True, the monarch is still crowned in Westminster Abbey, but it can only be a matter of time, I suggest, before that ceremony is either abolished altogether or, more likely, turned into a multi-faith ceremony. For religious pluralism has been effectively accepted as the new social reality. And Christianity, which was once the ideological spearhead of progress and empire, is increasingly marginalized, privatized, neutralized. Statistical analysis by a group of Christian researchers, some of you are probably familiar with, over the last 20 years, has shown quite clearly the way in which the numbers of church members in the UK has been declining constantly over that 20-year period, by about 1% of its value in 1970 every year. And you don't have to be much of a mathematician to calculate that if that trend isn't arrested, then by the year 2070 there'll be no church members at all. Well, of course, it is being arrested. There is an underlying groundswell. And that is a cause of encouragement for many. Indeed, some Christians are responding to this rather dismal and bleak picture of the decline of Christian influence in Britain by predicting very confidently that we're on the threshold of a major revival. Some even set out on ambitious prayer marches to claim back territory for Jesus from the demonic principalities and powers that have usurped the land. And I have to say, no one would be more overjoyed than I was if this optimism proved justified. But it does seem to me it's important to realize that there is another possible scenario. And it's that other, that alternative scenario, for which the books of Ezekiel and Daniel, it seems to me, are uniquely placed to prepare the church. In the days of Ezekiel and Daniel, there was also talk of speedy restoration and revival. But that was not the message which God had actually given to the true prophets, who were very much in the minority. The true prophets spoke rather of a very sad and tragic time of exile for the people of God. You will, I'm sure, be aware that the exile period found the Jewish community in a world uncannily like our own in some respects. A world of intoxicating economic affluence and intimidating power politics, but a world which suddenly was no longer shaped by biblical values and biblical ideas which had been foundational to Jewish culture. The book of Daniel, the first couple of verses, describes for us the historical background. You don't need to turn it up particularly unless you really want to. It tells us it's a story which is set during the exile, when the cream of Jewish society was skimmed out of Jerusalem and deported as hostages to the vast metropolis of Nebuchadnezzar's Babylon. A beautiful city, a city renowned in the ancient world, at that time in process of reconstruction, which would soon become one of the wonders of the ancient world. A city more impressive, more advanced in its architecture and its technology than anything the Jews had ever seen before. A magnificent city that made even Jerusalem at its height in the days of Solomon look dull and primitive by comparison. But most of all, a victorious city. The capital of an empire which had completely humiliated the armies of the ancient world, Judah included. The tragedy would not have probably been quite so serious if the Jews had been prepared to accept this situation with good grace and paid their taxes to Babylon and kept a low profile. But an insane, triumphalist national pride refused to let them do that. In 598 BC, their king Jehoiakim rebelled, and Babylonian reprisals were swift and effective. The rebellion was crushed, Jehoiakim was captured, probably in battle, and died shortly afterwards, possibly assassinated by his own people in order to secure a more merciful settlement. And the city of Jerusalem, after a brief siege, surrendered, and Jehoiakim's son, Jehoiachin, who'd only been on the throne 3 months together with 10,000 members of the Jewish aristocracy and the intellectual elite, were transported across the desert to Babylonia. It was a shattering blow. You just imagine for one awful moment that an enemy power conquered this country and captured you and forcibly transported you to a permanent new location in some foreign place. Even for those of us who are used to being tourists, it would be a pretty humiliating experience. And you can be sure it was even more traumatic for the Jews, because not only had they been a foreign country before, their whole national ideology centered around that tiny principality of Judah and its capital city, Jerusalem. This was the land of Canaan, the divine bequest to Abraham and his seed forever. This was the throne city of David, the royal dynasty that could never cease. This was the temple of Jehovah, the invincible God, before whom all other gods were supposed to be powerless idols. So talk about culture shock. To be a Jew and to be cut off from these sacred things was to jeopardize not just their cultural identity, but cast the seeds of the profoundest doubt on faith itself. That which for centuries they had been told was utterly impossible had happened. They had lost the promised land. They were exiles. Some simply couldn't absorb the shock. Mournfully they sat around their riverside encampments, bemoaning the loss of their homeland. By the rivers of Babylon we sat down and wept. We wept when we remembered Zion. How can we sing the Lord's song in a foreign land? They asked. It seemed impossible. But others, however, found the bitterness and resentment against their Babylonian masters fed the fires of that old political defiance once again. They refused to believe that what had happened was anything more than a temporary hiccup. There are plenty of Jews left, they said. Jerusalem under Zedekiah, Jehoiachin's uncle, is still viable. We're not finished yet. The situation's going to turn around. There's going to be a great restoration. It won't be long. Something great's going to happen. You'll see. We won't give in to these Chaldean imperialists. They'll get what's coming to them, all right. O daughter of Babylon, doomed to destruction, happy is he who repays you for what you've done to us. But unfortunately, such hopes of speedy restoration proved illusory. The seizure of tribute from the temple, which is mentioned in those early verses of Daniel, was only the beginning. 20 years after the first subjugation of the Jews, Nebuchadnezzar's troops had to return to Jerusalem to suppress rebellion, and on the final visit, around 587 BC, the emperor's patience came to an end, and he razed the city and its temple to the ground, and then exiled not just a handful of aristocrats to Babylon, but the bulk of the entire Jewish population. Now just put yourself then in the position of these Jews, and you will see, I think, why the books of Daniel and Ezekiel are rather appropriate and relevant to our situation today. Like us, they were hovering between hope and despair. Some were saying, revival is just around the corner. Others were saying, no, it isn't. The short term has no speedy answers, no speedy optimism for the people of God. Like us, they could remember days when biblical religion dominated their social horizons. But now paganism was no longer remote. They could no longer despise it as inferior superstition. For they no longer lived in a theocratic church state where religion and politics were so entangled it was impossible to separate them. The days when to be anything in society you had to be a faithful Jew, because it was unthinkable that anything else, had gone for good. It had all changed. The world had shrunk somehow. These rivals to biblical religion were not only on the doorstep, they had crossed the threshold, and the Jews found themselves, stripped of all their former privileges and power, in a vast secular empire. It was no longer to anybody's advantage or advancement to be a practicing Jew. On the contrary, social advancement was much more likely to come to those who showed themselves willing to accommodate to the culture and the lifestyle of their imperial masters. The challenge then was very similar to the sort of challenge that faces a Christian today. How do we understand what has happened? How do we interpret this decline of biblical religion in our land? Is it a temporary hiccup? Is it just a lull between two great revivals? Or is it something more serious than that? And how does one sustain and practice biblical faith in such a secular society, in which Christians are reduced to a rather unfashionable and rather odd religious minority? That question, as I say, which the books of Ezekiel and Daniel, it seems to me, are uniquely placed to try and answer for us. Some of you will know that John Woodhouse, not so long ago, gave some excellent lectures on the book of Ezekiel here at St. Helens, and those are available on tape. I imagine they're still available. He concentrated in his lectures on the relevance of that book for the preaching of the gospel, its relevance to evangelism, and how we interpret the Old Testament through a New Testament filter to preach the gospel from it. Those lectures are extremely worthwhile. There's very little I can say to add to them. And I've tried my best not to overlap too much with John Woodhouse's material, because I would like to look at these books from the other perspective, of course, which it's always possible to apply to Old Testament literature. Not only is Israel a model for us of the world and God's dealings with sinners in the world, Israel is also always a model for us of the covenant people of God, the church, and its sinfulness. And it's from that perspective that I'd like to look at these two books. How the exile feeds into our understanding of a church which is in decline, a church which no longer has power, and to a Christian population who feel themselves to be a minority, maybe an increasingly disadvantaged minority. Interestingly, both of these books, Ezekiel and Daniel, divide into two sections. Ezekiel 1 to 24 deals with the early part of the exile, and in it the prophet is interpreting theologically the reasons for the disgrace of Israel and the triumph of paganism. In Daniel's first part, Daniel 1 to 6, we find a series of stories designed to strengthen the faith of pious Jews in exile and to help them to know how to adapt to a situation in which they find themselves without the support of a national cultus for their faith. And both books, in their closing chapters, point to the future, to the authentic hope which the true prophets were prepared to hold out to the people of God in these bleak and dreary days of exile in which they lived, which was not a short-term hope, but a long-term hope of the kingdom of God, which, unlike the monarchy of Israel, or indeed the great pagan emperors of Babylon and its successors, would last forever. In the first two of these mornings, I want us to look at Ezekiel 1 to 24. In the second two, I want us to look at Daniel 1 to 6. And in the final morning, we shall look at those two sections which deal with the future. So today, we're going to start by looking at Ezekiel, the early chapters of it. I hope to span 1 to 11, though I shan't be saying very much about chapters 4 to 7. John Woodhouse did deal with those in some substance on the theme of judgment. So Ezekiel 1 to 11 is going to be the location of our references. If you want to open your Bible, that's the place to have it open. Now, the book of Ezekiel, of course, isn't an easy one, as you will know as well as I do. Most people who try to study it give up within a few chapters. There are a number of contributory factors to that. For a start, Ezekiel's writing is often ponderous and irritatingly repetitive. He tends to work his subject to death, rather. In addition, the vast bulk of the book is obsessed with the theme of divine retribution, an unpleasant subject at the best of times, and made far more unpalatable by the blood-curdling ferocity of some of Ezekiel's language. But perhaps the most difficult thing about the book is not so much the content or style as Ezekiel himself. For in the whole of the Bible, I think there never appears a more extraordinary figure. He is in every sense an eccentric. There's his habit, for instance, of illustrating his sermons with bizarre antics. Those who are interested in illustrating gospel preaching with drama must find a great advocate in Ezekiel. There are numerous examples of him doing precisely that in those chapters that I am very cleverly going to sidestep between chapters 4 and 7. On one occasion, he cuts off his beard with a whacking great military sword and does all kinds of peculiar things with the resulting hair, including weighing it in a pair of scales, cutting it up, burning it, throwing it in the air, and finally sewing it into the hem of his coat. On another occasion, he digs a tunnel out of his own house rather than use the front door. Another occasion, he lies on his side for what seems like a whole year, eating food cooked over cow dung. On top of this, there are his apparent psychic powers, his seeming telepathy that permits him to see in detail events that are happening 500 miles away, his seeming levitation, which enables him on occasions to rise above the surface of the earth and even to travel over it at remarkable speed. There are his outlandish visual experiences. There's his unnatural composure in the face of his wife's sudden death. There's the strange dumbness that seems to have afflicted him on and off throughout his ministry. In short, just about everything about this man seems in one way or another abnormal. He was probably a priest's son. At least that seems to be the implication of the early verses. The son of the priest Ezekiel, the priest, the son of Buzi. That presumably implies that he was a member of the tribe of Levi. He was certainly one of the 10,000 elite who'd been deported with Jehoiachin. And that no doubt means that as well as being a priest, he was a man of high rank in society. We find him later in the prophecy sitting among the elders of Israel, apparently commanding a considerable degree of respect there. But in spite of his aristocratic connections, Ezekiel was not by training, as I say, a politician or a landowner. He does seem to have been a priest. And that may very well be the clue to understanding this early example of eccentricity which bursts upon us in the very opening chapter. Quite suddenly and without warning, we're told, the heavens opened and I saw visions of God. I say his connection with the priesthood may be significant there, because according to the Levitical law, priests began their public ministry at the age of 30 years. And that may very well be why Ezekiel begins this chapter with the phrase, in the 30th year. Since verse 2 makes it plain that the year in question was actually the fifth year of Jehoiachin's exile, that is 593 BC, which as far as we know wasn't the 30th year of anything very special. John Taylor is probably right in his interpretation that the 30th year mentioned here is the age of Ezekiel at this time. We're perhaps to imagine this young man wandering along beside the river to which his group of exiles had been allocated, thinking about his future. This was his 30th year, maybe even his 30th birthday, for all we know. If he'd been back in Jerusalem, this would have been a time of real celebration, for he would have been committing his life to the divine vocation of service in the temple, which no doubt his father Abuzi had taught him to look forward to ever since he was a child. The day when he would have the privilege of touching holy things, maybe even of entering the sanctuary itself one day as high priest and seeing Jehovah's throne. Of all the Jews, it must have been the priests who felt the severance from Jerusalem the most intensely, mustn't it? Severance from the Ark of the Covenant, surrounded by those cherubim, full of smoke and fire, the symbol of God's living presence in the midst of his people, just as the book of Moses had described. Such thoughts must have been implanted very deep in Ezekiel's mind as a child by his father. But now such juvenile ambitions were nothing but empty dreams, for they were 500 miles from Jerusalem, and who could tell what would become of that beloved temple that he'd looked forward to visiting? There were rumors that Zedekiah was going to rebel again, given the right opportunity, but what would happen if he did? Would God miraculously intervene and save Jerusalem as he'd done before in the days of Hezekiah when the Assyrians attacked the city? There were prophets around who said undoubtedly he would. Within a few months we'll all be back in our homes, they preached. Everything will be back to normal. Don't worry, God's on our side. He's going to do something great soon. But were they right? Indeed, was God's arm long enough to stretch those 500 miles from Jerusalem to the river Kebar in Babylonia? And even if it were, was he willing to stretch it out for his people's deliverance at this time? So perhaps we are to imagine this young man, a little depressed, a little disappointed, certainly uncertain and bewildered, strolling aimlessly along the bank of the river, so deep in thought that he seems he doesn't notice the approaching desert storm until it's almost upon him, and then suddenly he's plunged into this furious cauldron of thunder and lightning. And there, as the natural elements do their best to terrify him, he suddenly finds himself face to face with something utterly supernatural. Did I say something? No, it's someone, isn't it? Verse 22, spread out above the heads of the living creatures was what looked like an expanse, sparkling like ice and awesome. Under the expanse, their wings stretched out one toward the other, and each had two wings covering its body. When the creatures moved, I heard the sound of their rushing waters like the voice of the Almighty, like the tumult of an army. And when they stood still, they lowered their wings. And then there came a voice from above the expanse over their heads as they stood with lowered wings. Above the expanse over their heads was what looked like a throne of sapphire, and high above on the throne was a figure like that of a man. I saw that from what appeared to be his waist up, he looked like glowing metal, as if full of fire, and that from there down he looked like fire, and brilliant light surrounded him. Like the appearance of a rainbow in the clouds on a rainy day, so was the radiance around him. This was the appearance of the likeness of the glory of the Lord. And when I saw it, I fell face down. Our skeptics, of course, have not been slow to call this a hallucination or to diagnose Ezekiel as a paranoid schizophrenic. Science fiction addicts have eagerly seized upon this event in an early encounter with a flying saucer. And I suppose if we had no other data to go upon, we might devise some such explanation ourselves from such a fantastic experience. But a comparison with the experience of other prophets makes such speculations quite unnecessary. Ezekiel's experience here was unusual, but not unique. It was clearly a theophany, a direct visual revelation of God to man, such as some of the other prophets had experienced, Moses on Sinai, Isaiah in the temple. It's important, I think, in reading his account of this revelation, not to get too bogged down with the detail of the prophet's portrayal of it. In fact, you notice the way Ezekiel keeps on repeating words like in appearance and likeness, when he actually does summon enough courage to speak of the representation of God which he sees on this throne. He piles qualification upon qualification to make sure nobody, absolutely nobody, thinks he's actually telling us what God looks like. This was the appearance of the likeness of the glory of the Lord, he says, putting three words between what he saw and what the Lord is really like. Clearly, Ezekiel is very conscious that he's trying to describe the indescribable. His language may well be symbolic, chosen to communicate the emotional shock of what he saw, or its theological significance, rather than an attempt to of the impossible task of verbally reproducing in our imaginations an exact replica of what it was he actually felt and saw then. In terms of literary art, this is an impressionist account. In fact, of course, Ezekiel is making a big step towards the development of apocalyptic, a literary genre which you're not intended to visualize. The only safe way to read it is to embrace the chapter and try to distill out of it the overall emotional impact and the coded symbolism of what it contains. And when one does that, I think it becomes clear that what Ezekiel saw was God's throne, something very similar to the man-made representation of that throne that occupied the Holy of Holies in the Jerusalem temple, which he knew about from his readings in the Old Testament in Moses. True, Moses only had two golden cherubim. Here Ezekiel saw four, but the general square box-like configuration that he describes and the overarching angelic wings touching each other is very similar to the Ark of the Covenant. And the mixture of fire and cloud that symbolize God's personal presence at the apex of Ezekiel's vision is strongly reminiscent again of the descriptions of the Shekinah glory which appeared in the temple above the cherubim whenever God wanted to indicate his special presence among his people. It was, of course, a common belief among the Jews at this time that the Ark of the Covenant was a copy of a real heavenly sanctuary, which Moses had made at a precise divine instruction. I think, suggests that what Ezekiel is being shown here, in his own mind at any rate, is a vision of that very heavenly sanctuary. I saw the heavens opened, he says. The veil of words and man-made depictions are for a moment rendered redundant as Ezekiel is given a glimpse of the real thing, or at least as close to the real thing as any mortal eye can bear. There's only one feature about this heavenly throne, which Ezekiel is quite emphatic about, but which finds no possible correlation either with the temple sanctuary or with previous visions of the divine glory, such as Isaiah's. You'll find that in verses 15 and following. This throne, this ark, had casters. As I looked at the living creatures, I saw a wheel on the ground beside each creature with its four faces. This was the appearance and structure of the wheels. They sparkled like chrysolite, and all four looked alike. Each appeared to be made like a wheel intersecting a wheel, and as they moved, they would go in any one of the four directions the creatures faced. The wheels did not turn about as the creatures went. Their rims were high and awesome, and all four rims were full of eyes all around. And when the living creatures moved, the wheels beside them moved. And when the living creatures rose from the ground, the wheels also rose. And wherever the spirit would go, they would go. And the wheels would rise along with them, because the spirit of the living creatures was in the wheels. Now, here is something unexpected and yet very important. This is not just a royal throne, you see. This is a royal chariot. If you remember, the Ark of the Covenant had to be carried by the priests on poles. But this throne moves on its own, conveying that mysterious and unutterable fiery brilliance wherever the Spirit of the Lord determines. And that, of course, is the principal significance of this initial vision. It's not hard, is it, to imagine how that impacted Ezekiel in the situation in which he found himself.
he was an exile. The great spiritual danger which the Jews stood in at that time was that in losing contact with the temple, they would feel deserted by God. They would feel that he who dwelt between the cherubim was remote from them. But now, in a single blast of prophetic illumination, this young man Ezekiel sees this is not so at all. For the ark in the temple was no more than a man-made replica. The real ark was infinitely more glorious, and more important for him, infinitely more mobile. God was not stuck in Jerusalem waiting for his priest to call up a Levitical taxicab. He was quite capable of moving under his own steam, thank you very much, and move he had. Believe it or not, he had moved to Babylonia, where his ailing people were. Now, of course, to us this seems a pretty self-evident truth, I guess. But to the Jews at this particular moment in the progress of divine revelation, surrounded as they were by the superstitious notion that God dwelt in shrines on the top of mountains, it was a theological breakthrough of enormous importance. Without this insight, of course, it was impossible for them to continue worshipping God in that foreign land. But with this new prophetic insight of Ezekiel's came the possibility of new expressions of Jewish piety that were not tied to a central cult, in a word, the synagogue. Here in Babylonia, a model of locally based worshipping communities would be created, which would be the model of New Testament churches. Secondly, without this insight, the faith of Israel would always have been tied to Jewish culture and Jewish tradition. A God who is only encountered in Jerusalem can only be the God of the Jews. But with this insight of Ezekiel's, a huge step is taken forward towards the universalizing of biblical religion. The dispersion of the Jews would mean that Judaism would begin to make contact, and could make contact, with paganism. Because this God was not anchored to that parent culture. Neither in Jerusalem nor on this mountain, one would come to say. God seeks those to worship him who worship him in spirit and in truth. But in addition, of course, to its theological implication, you can just imagine, can't you, the spiritual encouragement which such a revelation must have brought to this rather disillusioned and hopeless young man Ezekiel. His priestly vocation was not lost after all. God still had a vital job for a man like him to do, even in the midst of a pagan society. A bigger job than he could probably have anticipated. And that's what he goes on to tell him about, isn't it? I heard the voice of one speaking. He said to me, "Son of man, stand up on your feet and I will speak to you." And as he spoke, the Spirit came into me and raised me to my feet. I heard him speaking to me. He said, "Son of man, I am sending you to the Israelites, to a rebellious nation that has rebelled against me. They and their fathers have been in revolt against me to this very day. The people to whom I am sending you are obstinate and stubborn. Say to them, this is what the Sovereign Lord says. And whether they listen or fail to listen, for they are a rebellious house, they will know that a prophet has been among them." As many people entertain a certain romance about the Christian ministry, don't they? How marvelous it must be, they say, to spend all your time praying and studying the scriptures and helping people to know God. How incredibly fulfilling. No wonder clergymen have such a long life expectancy. Well, there may be some truth, of course, in what they say, but it is a dangerous half-truth, isn't it? Those of us who are actually in the ministry know that it would be wise to weigh carefully and with sober realism the call which God communicates to us, perhaps as we, excitable young men maybe, like Ezekiel was, feel the mantle of prophetic office might be descending on our shoulders. Ezekiel's being told here that he was in for an extremely difficult job. In fact, if you look on to chapter 3, verses 5 and 6, he's told that if he had been appointed as a cross-cultural missionary, he'd have had an easier job. We often, I think, have the idea of the missionary who works overseas in a far more demanding kind of role than the home-based pastor. And no doubt sometimes it is. But Ezekiel's told quite emphatically it would not be so in his case, and neither is it often, it seems to me. "You are not being sent," 3:5, "to a people of obscure speech and difficult language, but to the house of Israel, Not to many peoples of obscure speech and difficult languages, words you can't understand. If I sent you to them, they would have listened to you. But the house of Israel is not willing to listen, because they're not willing to listen to me. I can certainly testify from personal experience that whatever problems are raised by trying to communicate God's word through differences of language and culture overseas, they are more than compensated by the joy of working amongst a spiritually responsive people, a people who value your ministry. But to have to preach to a spiritually hardened society, albeit your own flesh and blood, is almost unendurably soul-destroying. So whilst I pray for missionaries in Africa and in South America, I pray perhaps even harder for pastors I know who are working in the desolation of inner cities or keeping a flickering light alive in an apathetic rural village, for they are the ones with the hardest task. Our modern, neo-pagan, secular society is far harder ground to dig than the mission field in many parts of the world. Like Ezekiel, such men aren't sent to foreigners. Foreigners would heed the gospel. They're sent to their own sin-hardened and rebellious fellow citizens. It's true, of course, that Ezekiel does experience certain compensations in this ministry. In 2 verse 9, for instance, we seem to find a picture of the personal satisfaction he found in being fed with God's word himself. I looked and saw a hand stretched out to me, and in it was a scroll, which he unrolled before me. On both sides of it were written words of lament and mourning and woe. And he said to me, Son of man, eat what is set before you. Eat this scroll, and then go and speak to the house of Israel. So I opened my mouth, and he gave me the scroll to eat. And he says in verse 3, it tasted as sweet as honey in my mouth. This I take to be a rather eloquent picture of the nature of prophetic inspiration. You notice the scroll is written on both sides, so there is no place for Ezekiel to add his own thoughts. This message is entirely the gift of God to him. It's 100% divine in origin. And yet this message, he's told, must become subjectively his own before he can... And he tells us finally the scroll was sweet to his taste, so that in spite of the fact that its contents were lament and mourning and woe, yet the man of God, it seems, finds a peculiar joy as he preaches this divine word, a joy which is independent of the severity of the message or even of the unresponsiveness of his audience. If his sermons blessed nobody else, Ezekiel's sermons at least seem to have blessed him. The other compensation you'll find in these early chapters of his calling are the promise of protection. Psychological and emotional protection, I think you could call it, in verses 7 to 9. The house of Israel is not willing to listen to you because they're not willing to listen to me. The whole house is obstinate, 2 verse 8, but I will make you as unyielding and hardened as they are. I will make your forehead like the hardest stone, harder than flint. Don't be afraid of them or terrified by them. So Ezekiel would find himself psychologically reinforced to withstand the bullying he would have to endure in this situation. He, no doubt, felt weak and inadequate. He would certainly be unum contra mundum, one man against the world. But God would see to it that there was a spiritual armor plating around him that couldn't be penetrated. He would insert vertebrae into his elastic spine. President Hoover, it was, wasn't it, coined that phrase, the rugged individualist. Prophets at this time of the exile, like Jeremiah and Ezekiel and Daniel, had to have that quality of rugged individualism about them. I suspect believers always have to in an exile situation. They have to be able to cope alone, especially if they're in the ministry. And Ezekiel's promised that he'll be able to do that. But neither the sweetness of the scroll nor the toughness of his forehead is comfortable, and it's going to be unsuccessful, he says. It will require physical courage because you're going to feel intimidated often. It's going to demand a personal integrity because the temptation to be silenced by this spiritual resistance of the audience will be high. So he says in verse 7, you must speak my words to them whether they listen or fail to listen. And it will require sustained commitment, we're told in verse 8.
because discouragement could easily breed surly resentment in the prophet himself at the job he was being called to do. But you, son of man, listen to what I say to you, and do not you rebel like that rebellious house. Open your mouth and you eat what I give you, he's told. So it would be immensely spiritually demanding. What's more, in these early experiences, Ezekiel is also shown how emotionally draining it's going to be. That comes out, I think, at the end of the first paragraph of chapter 3, in verses 12 and following of chapter 3, where we're told, the Spirit lifted me up, and I heard behind me a loud rushing sound. May the glory of the Lord be praised in his dwelling place. The sound of the wings of the living creatures brushing against each other, and the sound of the wheels beside them, a loud rushing sound. And the Spirit lifted me up and took me away, and here's the word I want you to note, I went in bitterness and in the anger of my spirit with the strong hand of the Lord upon me. Now, some have interpreted this bitterness and anger as Ezekiel being fed up with the job he'd been given to do. But I think that hardly accords with the warning in 2 verse 8 that he was to be a pliable and a willing servant, as opposed to the rebelliousness of Israel. Nor does it accord with this sudden burst of doxology in verse 12, which precedes the words. It seems much more likely to me that this bitterness of spirit is an early example of something we find again and again in Ezekiel. And that is the way in which God's feelings about the situation are, so to speak, incarnated in the prophet's own emotional makeup. He was angry because the word he had received and absorbed into his heart, into his very soul, was an angry word. The God before whose presence the angels bowed was a God whose heart was torn with disappointment and indignation. And Ezekiel identifies with God's heart. So the word of God which is upon him inflames him. Indeed, he's rendered literally speechless for a while by it in verse 15. I came to the exiles who lived at Tel Aviv, and I sat among them for 7 days, overwhelmed. Examples of this kind of emotional identification with the feelings of God in the situation are legion in the book of Ezekiel. One of the most outrageous, actually, is one which the NIV, it's from the chapters I'm not going to comment on in detail, in 6 verse 11, this is what the Sovereign Lord says, strike your hands together and stamp your feet and cry out, alas, because of all the wicked and detestable practices of the house of Israel, for they will fall by the sword, famine, and plague. Striking your hands together and stamping your feet in the ancient world was a cry of joy. It was the way in which you taunted your enemies. And this word, alas, I'm quite sure, should rather be translated, cry out, hooray. The NIV has ducked identifying Ezekiel with the feeling of triumph and joy in God's heart that the apostasy of his people was being so judged, that God could be glorified in judgment, that he could be glad that he was doing away with sin. But that's how dramatic Ezekiel's identification with the heart of God in the situation sometimes is. Well, you don't need much imagination to realize how that sort of emotional engagement with the message would drain the man. And those of us who are preachers all feel that to some extent, but for a prophet, must have been greatly intensified. God is also very frank in these opening chapters, isn't he, about what a formidably responsible task he was placing on this young man. In chapter 3, verse 16, son of man, I have made you a watchman for the house of Israel. So hear the word I speak and give them warning from me. When I say to the wicked man, you will surely die, and you do not warn him or speak out to dissuade him from his evil ways in order to save his life, that wicked man will die for his sin, and I will hold you accountable for his blood. A watchman, of course, is only needed in time of danger. He's the lookout who signals the approach of the invader so the city isn't taken by surprise. If you think about it, there's a profound irony about this particular watchman, because he's being appointed by the enemy. It is God who is carrying out judgment against Israel. It is God who is Israel's foe at this time. That's the whole thrust of these early chapters. And yet, ironically, it is he who puts the watchman in place and rings the alarm bell to warn of his hostile intent. A poignant commentary, of course, on the kind of God that God is. One who, in a sense, as we've just seen, is glorified in judgment, and yet one who, on the other hand, never delights in the destruction of the wicked. His longing is always to have opportunity to exercise mercy. As Luther puts it, wrath is his strange work. It is alien to his nature, for wrath is not an eternal attribute of God in the way that love is. His wrath is called into existence by the phenomenon of sin, and it is quenched out of existence when sin is dealt with to his satisfaction. Love, on the other hand, is an innate divine energy that burns eternally among the persons of the Trinity. And that's why the psalmist can say, his wrath is but for a moment, but his steadfast love endures forever. Certainly then a strange watchman, Ezekiel, to be hired by the very foe he's supposed to be frustrating. But in Ezekiel's case, this in no way mitigates the responsibility of the job. He's not just a token watchman. He has to do the job or pay for it. I will hold you accountable, he says, for his blood, if you fail to warn the wicked man. Two things, then, are required of the watchman, according to these verses. Alertness to see the enemy and faithfulness to blow the trumpet. And the same two things are required of God's watchman. Alertness to the divine word. Ezekiel must rightly discern what God is saying to his generation. He must not fill them with false hopes. He must not cry peace when there is no peace. He must rightly discern the warning God is giving to an idolatrous people. And then he must be faithful in delivering it, in spite of the unpopularity, in spite of the uncongenial nature of the message. He must diligently communicate that word, undistorted in its content and imperative in its tone, he's told. To fail to do so implicates you in the fate of the wicked, Ezekiel. To know that God's judgment must fall upon such a people and to fail to do anything to avert it is culpable negligence, he says. I will call you to account for their blood. And that surely represents the greatest challenge of these opening chapters to a church, to faithful, believing people in a secular age like us. I said at the opening, there were many in Ezekiel's day who expected a speedy restoration of Israel to her former glories, who predicted revival was imminent, that it was only a matter of days or weeks before they would be back in Jerusalem and God would turn the tide for his people. But that was not the message God gave to Ezekiel. Not in the short term, anyway. He has something to say to him about revival. But Ezekiel's first word has to be a word of judgment. And that surely is something we must take on board. We have to beware of ill-founded optimism. For premature talk of imminent revival may all too easily subvert the authentic word of God to an apostate church, to an idolatrous nation. A nation who have rejected the faith of their fathers in favor of the idols of modernity. The first word of a prophet to any such pagan world, any such idolatrous world, must be a word of judgment. In this sense, the church, as salt and light of the earth, has to be a watchman, rightly discerning what God's word is bound to be against a sinful people. It's not enough, then, to sit in our churches each Sunday cultivating a sense of spiritual euphoria with triumphalist choruses, it seems to me, about how God is going to give the land we claim into our hands. For there is a message of somber judgment upon the world and, I judge, against the church, which must be heard. And the signs of that judgment are to be found not in our songbooks, but often in our daily newspapers and in our church newspapers. For the Christian community to fail in that, to fail to rightly discern the times, if you like, may very well be to fail to be a watchman. May very well be to join the ranks of the false prophets who cried peace, peace when there was no peace. It may very well turn out to be a watchman with blood on our hands.